and welcome to Ahead of the Curve, the podcast from Acadiasoft, where we take time out to get under the skin of the margin and collateral industry, to dig deep and present topical perspectives and insights on this hugely important sector. Now, since the mid-1980s, interbank offered rates, or IBOR, have been used as a key global benchmark to price and value loans, bonds, derivatives, and all sorts of other financial products. But change is on the way. Regulators are looking to phase out IBORs for new risk-free rates, or RFRs, by the end of 2021. So why is this happening? And what does it mean for businesses and global financial markets? To discuss this, I'm joined by two expert guests. Anne Battle is Head of Benchmark Reform at ISDA, the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, and John Pucciarelli is Director of Strategic Initiatives at Acadiasoft. Anne, John, welcome.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Now, before we go any further, it'd be great to find out a little bit more about yourselves and your roles at both ISDA and Acadiasoft. Anne, I'm going to come to you first. Welcome again. Tell me a little bit about your role at ISDA.
Sure, thanks. So I'm currently the head of benchmark reform at ISDA. I work directly in the legal and policy teams, but I've been coordinating our LIBOR transition and other benchmark reform work globally across all of our different groups. I've represented ISDA on the ARC for the past few years, and I coordinate with my colleagues in other jurisdictions who represent ISDA on the other RFR or risk-free rate working groups in those jurisdictions. I also lead ISDA's work with the Financial Stability Board, or FSB, Official Sector Steering Group, or OSSG, which is the group of global regulators and central banks that have focused on benchmark reform over the last 7+ years.
So plenty on your plate there. And how do you juggle all of this?
When I first joined ISDA, I focused my time on benchmark reform, some clearing issues, and a number of other topics. Benchmark has definitely taken up the majority of my time recently. But as we'll discuss, all of this work does relate and does go together. So it's a juggle, but it's all pieces of the same puzzle.
Well, it's great to have you on Ahead of the Curve. John, you're no stranger to the podcast. Welcome back again. Tell us a bit about your role at Acadiasoft.
I've been at Acadiasoft now since 2019. Time flies. We're almost at the end of 2020. I head up regulatory and industry initiatives for Acadiasoft. And a lot of that is dealing with regulators directly, talking to them about our products and our services, and also working with our clients, being a subject matter expert on the uncleared margin rules. I was previously at ISDA, and that's kind of my focus was the uncleared margin rules. I was part of the project team that created the Standard Initial Margin Model, or SIM, and I led a lot of those efforts to get the first four phases through. So at Acadiasoft, I use a lot of that experience to kind of explain challenges in that space, in the uncleared margin space, to our clients for, you know, all of the great services that we provide for the market to help them deal with that. So that's pretty much it in a nutshell, I would say.
And it's been obviously, as we've all experienced and seen and felt for ourselves, it's been a challenging time over the last 6 months, the pandemic, economic slowdown notwithstanding. How's that affected you at Acadiasoft, the conversations that you've had with your clients, just in terms of the pace of work?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think in the beginning of the lockdown, people were just trying to understand what that pace was. We did see regulators, I always have my regulator hat on. We saw regulators react to this and kind of give delays to some of the rules, understanding that, you know, folks who were now working from home had potential issues and not wanted to focusing on just getting regulatory compliant for whatever the regs are, whether they're margin regs or even what we're going to talk about today, which is LIBOR reform. But I think in those first couple months it was a little tricky, but I think people found their stride, and you know, we haven't stopped talking to clients, and I don't feel the sense that clients really have put down their pens. Things keep moving along, and I guess we'll see what the rest of the year holds. But so far, not huge change. It's as far as from my perspective, actually.
Oh, that's good to hear. So there's plenty of ground for us to cover here in this particular edition of Head of the Curve. Like you say, we're looking at the move from IBORs to RFRs, the whole change that's in place here. And I want to come to you first. Give me the industry view. Why are we seeing a move from IBORs to RFRs?
Yeah, so many of you will be aware that LIBOR first came to light several years ago in connection with the fixing scandals.
If I just jump in, so LIBOR's being the predecessor to IBOR as well.
So LIBOR is an IBOR. So IBOR generally stands for Interbank Offered Rate. And there are a number of IBORs. LIBOR in the five currencies in which it is published being US dollar, sterling, Swiss franc, euro, and Japanese yen being one of the most widely used IBORs, particularly US dollar LIBOR and sterling LIBOR. The scandal I mentioned was with respect to LIBOR in particular and did result in reforms to LIBOR as well as a number of these other IBORs. LIBOR in particular, since 2017, has been expected to cease in the near term, even though, as I mentioned, there were successful reforms to put in place enhanced governance as a result of the recent scandals. The issue that with LIBOR that applies to different degrees with respect to other IBORs is that they are meant to be based on interbank funding. And when these rates were first used, there was an active interbank market. And so the panel banks that contribute to LIBOR and other IBORs were able to submit based on transactions that those banks actually entered into. So, for example, they could submit to three-month US dollar LIBOR based on actual three-month transactions that that bank entered into in the interbank market. However, that is no longer really how banks fund themselves as a result of today's market and some of the liquidity reforms that came out of the 2008 financial crisis. Therefore, when banks submit to LIBOR in particular, they're primarily submitting based on what's called expert judgment. And that means that the bank has to submit based on what they could borrow for the relevant term in the relevant market. That's difficult in any event, but it's exceedingly difficult when those transactions don't even exist because there is no market for those transactions. When you couple that difficulty with the necessary and enhanced governance that surrounds submitting to LIBOR, it exposes these banks to a lot of liability. And so the key reason for moving away from IBORs is really twofold. One is to move the bulk of financial markets to rates that are considered more robust, to rates that are built on actual transactions in the market, but also because in the case of LIBOR, panel banks, due to the liability I mentioned, are no longer willing to continue submitting. And that I mentioned an announcement in 2017. That was the announcement. At that time, Andrew Bailey, who was then the chief executive of the UK Financial Conduct Authority, or FCA, announced that it was currently having to actually compel or force panel banks to submit to LIBOR because they would prefer to drop out. And he specifically announced that after the end of 2021, the UK FCA would no longer compel or persuade those banks to submit. And if the banks don't submit, then it is not possible to publish LIBOR in its current form. The risk-free rates that we'll hear about, such as SOFR in US dollar, SONIA in pound sterling, etc., are instead based on actual transactions. Now, they're based on overnight transactions, so they are materially different from LIBOR and the other IBORs, but you don't have the panel bank submission problem because, for example, in the case of SOFR, the New York Fed has data for the repo markets and utilizes that data to calculate and publish SOFR on a daily basis. And so there's no, there's no involvement from the panel banks. It's actually driven completely by transactions. And those are the type rates that central banks and regulators identified as the most robust and safe rates for use in the broader financial markets.
Is that what would get the crux to here? There's obviously a lot of parts to this, but that notion of a more robust system. You mentioned LIBOR at the beginning, and the London Interbank Offered Rate was the story of manipulation, ultimately, wasn't it? And a breakdown in trust. And is this a route out of that then for the future?
I think it's important to understand that the manipulation was addressed by better governance. So we're not necessarily moving to these rates because there was manipulation. We're moving to these rates because a rate built on panel bank submissions, when the panel banks are exposed to too much liability for submitting, is not a sustainable rate. And that has proven to be true in the case of LIBOR. So I think I mentioned that the reason is really twofold, and I went into the robustness of risk-free rates. But the other part of that is, in the case of LIBOR in particular, it's not going to be around long term. It's not a rate that can be sustained. So in any event, the market has to find an alternative, or otherwise there will be no interest rate. So there's the desire to move to more robust rates, but then there's also the just stark reality of the future of LIBOR in particular.
Yeah, some fascinating thoughts there. And John, I want to bring you in here. Can you pick up on Anne's comments there? This notion that there's an inexorable move in this direction, an essential move in this direction. How do you see the market moving in the cleared and the bilateral OTC, the over-the-counter space, for instance?
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, and I think we'll talk a little bit more about it. But in terms of cleared, right, we are seeing, and we have already seen, moves towards risk-free rates as really part of the global industry efforts around benchmark reform. So the most systemic CCPs, or central clearing counterparties, they switch their PAI, or their price in line interest and discounting on the euro side of things, on all euro denominated products, to Esther. And I think it was this past July, Anne, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was originally set for June of this year, but I believe that COVID may have delayed that. That has happened, right? So we're seeing this move happening in CCPs. In terms of US denominated derivatives, the move to SOFR is still set for next month. So it's coming, it's in October of 2020. So we're seeing a ton of movement in the cleared space. It's happening now. As Anne mentioned, these rates are going away in 2021. Banks are not going to be compelled to submit to these rates. But the CCPs in the cleared space have already moved towards it in a kind of a big bang way, so to speak. A little bit different in the bilateral space, where it's not going to be any big bang, although we'll talk about protocols and we'll talk a little bit about, how firms might be looking at changing their legal documentations in the bilateral space. But in that case, it's more of a measured bilateral approach, meaning it's not going to, it's not designed like the CCP, like the cleared world, not designed to go all at once. And it's going to work similarly. I think there's some good background, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of the you know, the stuff that's out there to help people in the bilateral space move towards risk-free rates. But it will have, like, the cash flow will be similar in terms of, well, do you book a basis trade to offset, or do you compress, things like that. But, you know, in the bilateral space, it's much different. And whatever happens in the cleared world does not affect the bilateral world. So there's kind of two different worlds working here in the derivative space. One cleared, which is already moving towards risk-free rates, and the bilateral space, which is going to move a little bit differently and maybe at a slower pace. But eventually, you know, these are all, like Ann said, these are all going to go away in 2021. So they'll move there. But I think we'll get into the details in terms of some of how that movement is going to work in the bilateral space.
And some clear movement there, as you say, October fast approaching. So as we move from IBOR, what will the impact be on firms, do you think, John, especially when it comes to trading implications, swap pricing, legal documentation, and so on? What are you sensing when it comes to firms, that impact, what it will be?
Yeah, I mean, this reaches a lot of things, right? You know, LIBOR is in a lot of different instruments in trading. On the legal documentation side, kind of where we're looking at it from an AcadiaSoft perspective, you know, I think one of the main considerations that we're seeing is from a credit support annex from your CSAs, the discounting in the bilateral space will definitely factor in, right? So firms are now kind of taking a look at their remediation plans and kind of trying to understand, okay, well, you know, if I'm discounting using LIBOR in the CSA and I start moving to risk-free rates, how is that going to affect my swap pricing? Do I use two different credit support annexes, meaning, you know, I just leave my legacy IBORs in one bucket, and as I start to put on swap trades that reference risk-free rates, do I create another CSA to make it more simplified in terms of pricing? Or do I use one CSA and combine the entire portfolio? That may cause some challenges in terms of swap pricing as well. So these are all different considerations. We're talking to our clients. I think generally speaking, from a, you know, again, this is the legal documentation side of things. It translates down into your collateral process, because now if you have two CSAs, you're going to be calculating potentially two different margin calls. Most firms probably don't want to do that. We've done some surveys and asked around, and seems like most of the swap dealers anyway are looking at one credit support annex. But again, that causes a little bit more complexity in terms of how you discount, because now you have two different benchmarks that you have to discount with your collateralized portfolio and how that works.
Complexity, John, also, you know, some might say that can lead to confusion and at the very least reduced efficiencies. Is that a concern among firms?
I think it is. I think it's kind of, you know, it depends on which side of the complex process you want to pick, whether it's the pricing side to make it easier or whether it's the downstream, you know, collateralized part of it. I think either way, you're going to have some level of complexity. There's no, you know, even though there's a ton of great content out there to help folks remediate this and ways to do it, it's still work. There's still a lot of complexity, whether you do it upstream or downstream. You just pick your poison. And I hate to use the word poison, but it's true. It's reality. So, you know, we'll talk a little bit more later about project plans and things and getting ready, because this is coming and it's coming fast and soon. But yeah, I mean, it's complex one way or the other.
We'll definitely get onto that. And John's mentioned credit support annexes, CSAs here. Played a key role in developing them as well. What's your view on this particular point?
Yeah, so as John mentioned, the collateral changes that result from these benchmark reform efforts really relate to US dollar and euro. And that's because the risk-free rates identified as alternatives in those currencies were not the rates that are currently used for interest amount, which is a field in CSAs. And in the cleared space, as John alluded to, were not the rates that were used for price alignment and discounting. And so, interestingly, the move to these rates for collateral purposes in US dollar and euro have nothing to do with LIBOR or other IBORs. However, they were identified as steps that could increase the liquidity in the relevant risk-free rates. And I should have mentioned what they are, but they're SOFR for US dollar and Euro SDR or ESTR for Euro. Historically, CCPs have definitely used EONIA for Euro discounting and price alignment and Fed funds for US dollar price alignment and discounting. And as a result, most counterparties have used EONIA and Fed funds respectively for interest amount paid on euro and US dollar collateral. Again, the idea is that if the market moved the rates used for those purposes related to collateral to SOFR and euro STR, that would encourage additional use of those rates. And in turn, that would increase liquidity in the rates, so they would be stood up as more viable alternatives to IBORs denominated in US dollar and euro. And so, as John mentioned, the switch from EONIA to euro SDR for cleared euro derivatives happened in July and was relatively uneventful. However, that may have been relatively uneventful because EONIA is currently published as a tracker for Euro SDR. So there was a relatively straightforward way for the CCPs to calculate the difference in value and exchange compensation for that difference. The CCP change for US dollar is coming up in the middle of October. And that's going to be a little bit less straightforward because Fed funds and SOFR are not correlated in the way that EONIA and Euro STR are correlated. And so the central counterparties or CCPs are going to engage in a compensation mechanism that involves both cash and the issuance of basis swaps. So Fed funds, SOFR basis swaps. For market participants with cleared exposure that cannot or don't want to hold those basis swaps, the CCPs will also be running an auction process. There's a few takeaways from that. One is that the basis swaps themselves will increase liquidity in SOFR transactions, but the market really needs to understand what the implications of potentially holding or transacting in a market after those basis swaps are issued.
And thanks for clarifying those points. How does this impact CSAs?
As I mentioned, the relevant term in CSAs for non-clear derivatives is interest amount. A change from EONIA to Euro SDR and or from Fed funds to SOFR is completely voluntary in the non-cleared amount. But I think counterparties that have cleared and non-cleared exposure will likely desire consistency and therefore will likely take advantage of templates that ISDA recently published for counterparties to negotiate a change. And these templates allow for the counterparties to go from any interest amount on US dollar or euro. In the euro market, I think there is another reason to make the change to CSAs. And, you know, as has been mentioned, EONIA will actually cease at the end of 2021. And so to the extent counterparties have a CSA that continues to reference EONIA as an interest amount, that is another push in addition to the desire for conformity with cleared markets.
So, Anne, just moving on, what does this mean for the ISDA rates definitions changes that are in hand? When does it go into effect? Is there a protocol and how will it work? Three questions for you there.
Yeah, sure. So now I'm going to switch gears from collateral to the actual floating rates in your interest rate derivatives. And that's going to lead us back into a world of directly addressing the cessation of LIBOR or even another IBOR. So since 2016, ISDA was tasked by the FSB OSSG that I mentioned earlier with updating our standard definitions for interest rate derivatives, which is a different definitional booklet than the new collateral definitions booklet, so that references to LIBOR and other key IBORs contain fallbacks. To level set, currently those definitions have a fallback to what's called a reference bank pull. And that means if LIBOR or another IBOR is unavailable for any reason, including just a technical glitch or a permanent cessation, then the calculation agent, which is one of the counterparties, would be tasked with calling banks in the relevant market and asking what the rate should be. That has worked in the technical glitch situation, but it certainly would not work in a permanent cessation. It's very unlikely that any banks would give an answer to a rate that no longer exists. And even if they did, it would result in great inconsistencies across the market. And so that's why ISDA began work to update its definition so that if a key interest rate benchmark such as LIBOR or another IBOR is discontinued, contracts that continue to reference that rate would reference an actual benchmark as opposed to just a mechanism for determining a rate. And given that SOFR, SONIA, Euro SDR had been identified as the more robust alternatives, we spent a couple of years, as I mentioned, consulting the market on what adjustments should apply. We now have Bloomberg publishing the adjusted rates. So if the fallbacks apply, for example, in US dollar LIBOR, the rate referenced in those contracts will be an adjusted form of SOFR. However, as counterparties today look at a screen to find out what, say, 3-month US dollar LIBOR is, Bloomberg is publishing what the adjusted fallback rate will be. So a 3-month adjusted SOFR. And at a very high level, SOFR will be compounded over the relevant period, so the relevant 3-month period in that example. And then there will be a spread adjustment added to it, and that spread adjustment will be calculated based on the median over a 5-year period of the difference between the IBOR and the risk-free rate. So the difference between US dollar LIBOR and SOFR compounded over each period in that 5-year window, given that it's not expected to exist in its current form for much longer.
John, what's your reflection on this from Acadiasoft's position? When you speak to clients as well, what are they telling you in respect of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Anne has laid out is kind of like that the broad picture. You know, it's interesting that she's mentioned fallbacks and how that's going to work. I do think that there is still a lot of questions. From my perspective, and from an Acadiasoft perspective, I still think that all of this information and all the information that's being laid out, especially here in this podcast and everywhere else, still needs to be broadcasted through, because, if you start talking about, well, what is my legacy trade going to look like? Anne mentioned Bloomberg. There are some tools that are going to help you understand what the pricing implication is going to be on a particular swap trade, et cetera. How the protocol is going to work. So it's just, there is a lot. I don't know that everyone understands, you know, what is out there. But there's certainly plenty out there to help you understand and help you remediate. From my perspective, too, from really, again, from a legal documentation perspective, when we talked about this, you know, it's utilizing, you know, some of the tools out there to understand, okay, well, how do I even change my legal documentation? What is out there so I can even understand where some of the, you know, where I'm referencing Fed funds for interest, as Ann pointed out. How do I even know this? Do I have to just pull all of my documents and you know, have people like run through them? That's one way to go. And then there's other, you know, technology providers out there like us and others that can help you do that. So that's kind of what we're seeing. I don't really, you know, we're not looking at it from the trading perspective. A lot of the stuff that Ann is kind of laying out is from a kind of a front office trading perspective, but it also cuts through other aspects of the life cycle of a trade and what the remediation of IBORs means to our clients.
And is there any uncertainty then amongst the clients you're speaking to, John, about what the implications are for documentation, or is there a clear message there?
I think the message that things need to change is clear. I just think that how you go about it isn't. But that being said, ISDA and Ann mentioned ARC and the FCA have put out a ton of material, especially ARC. You know, I'm a little bit more familiar with ARC under the New York Fed. You know, there's a lot of good information to help firms. So it's really more about getting that message across. I know ISDA's doing quite a bit, and we're trying to do our part here at AcadiaSoft as well. We have webinars coming up on this topic, and this is why we're talking about this topic today, really, is to make sure that people understand what they need to do, what the implications are, and give them the background of why it's happening. So,
well, John, thank you for those thoughts. We're out of time now, unfortunately. Ann Battle, John Pucciarelli, thank you both very much indeed. And thank you for listening to Ahead of the Curve. We'd like to know what you think, so please do get in touch and share your thoughts. And you can find out more about AcadiaSoft by going to www.acadiasoft.com.